Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, has democracy become like fast food? We'll discuss slow democracy. Then, as polarization continues in our Congress and presidency, what should we expect in this next term? Should democracy slow down? Is it too much like fast food? Our next guest argues that it is. Susan Clark is co-author of Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home. Welcome, Susan Clark.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Let's start with your basic concept, your idea of slow democracy, that perhaps moving too fast, you lose some aspects of democracy.
That's right. We're taking the inspiration from the slow food movement, you know, which I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of, which argues that fast food symbolizes a lot of what's wrong with the world today. You know, in the name of efficiency, we've kind of centralized and overprocessed a lot of what's worthwhile out of our lives. And so slow food argues that we should understand our agricultural systems and our connection to place and to natural world. And in that same way, with slow democracy, we're arguing that we should reconnect with our decision-making and to place and to our local democracy, and that we'll make better informed, more sustainable decisions using that local knowledge.
A couple of arguments that you make in here. One is that localization argument, and the other is decentralization. What are the limitations that you see?
Well, I think that many policymakers, whether mindfully or simply out of neglect, have siphoned a lot of power and deliberative democratic opportunities away from communities. And this is oftentimes based on sort of that Industrial Revolution idea of efficiency and how helpful it is to centralize things for economies of scale. And all of these decisions, I think, are made with good intention and goodwill. But we've lost a lot of the benefits of community democracy. And, you know, we see this, for example, in the planning world. In the 1960s, we saw a lot of urban renewal where they tore down, you know, inner city neighborhoods, but without consulting the people in those neighborhoods, and oftentimes really destroyed healthy social fabric, community fabric. And, you know, we see it sometimes in rural school consolidation where we close small schools sometimes without acknowledging or even understanding what happens to a community that loses its school as a gathering place or as a civic training ground for parents, as an entryway for personal leadership. So some of these elements of community, we think of them sometimes as old-fashioned, but in fact, there are some new studies that show that a strong community really has a powerful impact on many aspects of our future.
So the reason I was asking about the limitation aspect of it is it seems there are some things that really operate well on the local decision-making level, and some things that maybe should be given to a central entity.
Absolutely, yes. And we have a chapter in our book where we talk, for example, about the civil rights movement, which, you know, in many ways began at the local level, but really had to have a national entity come in to enforce some of the decisions that were being made by society but were being resisted at the community level. And we have a few other examples in history that really show that there's a time and a place for centralized democracy. But what we're worried about is that the pendulum has swung a little too far in terms of centralized decision-making and also in terms of privatizing many of our democratic decision-making processes and some of the things that we ask our government or our commons to care for.
Now, of course, privatization takes the decision-making completely out of the public hands. One of the questions that comes up among political scientists and political theories deals with, like here in the U.S., people deal with having to make a lot of democratic decisions and so many democratic decisions they couldn't possibly do it without having a full-time job as a democratic decision maker. So, for example, they have to decide their school board members, their county council people, their city council people, their state representative, their state senator, their state governor, their congressperson, their federal senator, the president, the water district, the judges, even here a radio station board, and all of the ballot propositions.
Sure. And there are places that, you know, Switzerland, for example, has also many times they're voting 3 and 4 times a year on multiple ballot measures. And, you know, they have democracy fatigue that they complain about. It's, I think, relatively rare in terms of, you know, when you ask people why they're pulling back from, you know, how they feel about their government, how do they feel about democracy. Most of the time, what we hear is people who feel disempowered and disenfranchised, as opposed to being asked too many things. And a lot of sadness, I think, the statistics show, about people's loss of faith in government. I think one of the key elements of slow democracy is that the decisions that we do take time to make, to make sure that that's a quality decision-making process, rather than, for example, maybe asking me to pick between two potential water board members. Maybe a better use of my time would be every few years to pull me in to a conversation at the beginning of a policymaking process about water, where I'm able to really shape and guide some of the values that go into the decision-making process that then my elected officials will take on. Many times when people say, I don't have time for democracy, what I hear is, I hear that as a challenge. I hear that as, my time is precious. Make it worth my time to be part of democracy. And that doesn't mean give me yet more boring hearings to go to and to maybe offer my opinion at, but offer me an inclusive, truly deliberative and empowered process where I can make a difference in something that matters to me. And that's where we really see people really shine.
Well, let's talk about some of these. You had some great examples, and perhaps we can just go through some of them and talk about how they are developing. Let's move to Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Portsmouth is a wonderful story, and it's a little city of about 20,000 people right on the border of New Hampshire and Maine. And they had a big employer there about 20 years ago, the Pease Air Force Base. But that Air Force Base shut down. They lost about, 4,000 military personnel, another 2,400 related jobs. And, we all know what it feels like to have, a displaced economy. But there was sort of insult to injury there in Portsmouth because they ended up with badly skewed elementary schools, two elementary schools that were very under-enrolled and one that was just bursting at the seams. And it was a political hot potato. I think, as many people know about redistricting and those kinds of questions, very tricky to move kids, and parents were very resistant. So it just got pushed down the road year after year for 10 years. There were kids being taught in the hallways and, teachers, with broom closets for offices. So finally, the school board and superintendent got innovative and took a chance on something called study circles, which is a process put up by the Everyday Democracy Group, which is a wonderful, inclusive, deliberative, empowered, we call it slow democracy, kind of process. And they started really by beating the bushes, making sure that they had good participation from all across the different schools, all the different neighborhoods, and started with a small group process, so broke up into small conversational groups where they could really build trust and start to understand where each other were coming from. And they agreed to meet for over the series of, I think it was 5 or 6 meetings, and rotated among the three schools, so they really got good information on the ground. And because of those conversations and really good on-the-ground research, they were able to, rather than just talk about, my answer is best and here's what I think we should do, talk about the underlying values. And that's it's the slow part of slow democracy, but it's what really builds the best new creative answers. They came up with answers that the school board hadn't even considered. And their recommendations were scooped up by the school board, and in the end, after 10 years of frustration, the school board proposed, it was about $2 million at that point, I think, in facility improvements, which received broad support and were approved by the community. And the proposal was so well informed by the citizens that it would affect that it just made a lot of sense on the ground. There were only 65 students who had to switch schools. So I think one of the most exciting things about Portsmouth is that they have really gone on to use this kind of study circle, inclusive, deliberative, empowered process over and over again over the years. They've used it to create a community sustainability plan. They've used it in their master planning process. They've used it in multiple issues, and it's really changed the way the town does their work.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Susan Clark about her new book, Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home. Are there other cities that you think are doing that well, larger ones?
Sure. Austin, Texas, has some wonderful, very much interested in dialogue and deliberation, and that's a much bigger city. But they are able to use, for example, neighborhood community centers to get input on their master planning process by using something they've created called Meeting in a Box, where they map out what they would like people to talk about, and then use the social capital that exists right there in those neighborhoods and have the meetings in pre-existing groups. And they use the process that and ask the questions that the city would love to have citizens' answers on, and then feed those back in to the community planning process.
Now, how does the factor of NIMBYism, not in my backyardism, affect something like this?
Well, it's very important, obviously. The thing that deliberation does, and we define that pretty rigorously, it doesn't just mean talking. It means a respectful interaction, oftentimes facilitated, where you really are backing away from predetermined decisions, and rather than, you know, trying to argue about A versus B, you're kind of co-creating C, if you can imagine. So people are able to get away from the NIMBY stance that they may have come to the meeting with, and really explore the common values that they have with other people in the room. And that's what happened in Portsmouth. I think many, many people came to those meetings knowing exactly what they thought should happen. But they weren't asked, what do you think should happen? Instead, they were asked, well, what are some of the values that the school board needs to consider when we're making this decision? And so they backed away from those immediate decisions, and that's the new brain studies that are coming out are showing that that's when we can find the creative solutions and get away from some of that gridlock that we've unfortunately gotten so used to these days.
Let's talk about some of the ways in which these creative processes work. Some examples that you used were really creative, like theater and this group called Apathy is Boring.
Sure, absolutely. You know, we really ask people to think of government as a we and not a they. And that's pretty hard for a lot of people who are used to, many people I talk with just say politics is something I don't do. They've really just gotten so burned out on that kind of decision making. But if we can, you know, really think about it as we the people, we can start to come up with better solutions that way. And I think it was the California city manager who said that too often we're looking at government as if it's a vending machine, and we should just put our money in one end and the services come out the other, and if it doesn't work, we kick it. Well, that's not what the founders had in mind. So, you know, with slow democracy, we're saying no drive-through democracy, you know, needs to be an inclusive deliberative process that really, you know, we need to leave a little time to carry it out. And it should, of course, wield power. You know, one of the benefits that these, in particular, some new studies on deliberation, one of them in deliberation in juries, has shown that's very exciting to me is that when we get involved in decision-making, local decision-making that is truly deliberative, we come away changed, and it creates a virtuous spiral within the community. For example, with the jury system, you know, regular people off the street that for a few days or weeks out of their lives, you know, are making very empowered binding judgments as part of the democratic system. These remarkable new studies show jury service raises voting rates. So if I am a juror, I am likely to go on for the rest of my life to vote more regularly. It often increases political activity. It often improves self-confidence just in your own political abilities. People are likely to get more involved in community groups, follow public issues in the news more, and many people say that their faith in their fellow citizens is increased, all because of these kinds of small-scale deliberations. So these are the kinds of processes that can really reweave our democratic fabric.
How is technology facilitating deliberative democracy?
Absolutely. And you know, technology is a tool, like any other tool. You can use a hammer to build things or you can use a hammer to destroy things. And there are some wonderful new technologies that allow people, not only, of course, we all know that the Internet allows us to organize ourselves better, inform ourselves better. We're able to become organized at the at network and whatnot. But also, there's software that allow us to actually hold online deliberations, so that with people who may not be able to come to a meeting or be in the room. There are also some wonderful, here in Vermont, we have something called Front Porch Forum. In Minnesota, they have eDemocracy. These are listserv types of communications that are very specifically neighborhood-based. They aren't as big as, you know, Facebook or anything like that, but they're intended to connect neighbor with neighbor on neighborly things. Things like, you know, has anybody seen my lost cat? Or I need to borrow a canoe. Or would anybody, you know, need some new snow tires? those kinds of communications. But also at the same time, as I'm reading through my daily digest, did you know there's a meeting tonight at the Planning Commission? And, here's a way that you can feed your opinions into the school board. So really tend to, these are technologies that don't keep us in front of our computers. They get us out talking to our neighbors.
When you have these deliberations, whether they are online or in a living room conversation, how does one keep them from spiraling out into the ugly politics that we see?
Isn't that a great question? And I know the people who have created Front Porch Forum have wrestled with that problem quite a bit. One of the most important, helpful ways, especially at a community level, is anonymity is discouraged. And in fact, in some of these, it's not allowed. So it's the same thing that happens here in New England when we have a town meeting. I'm likely to be more civil with my neighbor if I'm speaking with them face-to-face. And they know that, next week, they might be driving by as my car is in a snowbank. You know, I'm going to hope that they're going to pull me out. So there's a certain neighborliness that, a level of civility that is encouraged by that lack of anonymity. But a good facilitator also goes a long way, because facilitators have a way of keeping us on track and keeping us focused on not on the personalities, but on the problem at hand.
Even people who are very close sometimes break down into very ugly dialogue instead of deliberation.
It happens. It definitely happens. But we have especially when issues are well-framed and it's clear that we're moving toward an empowered decision-making end, it's much more likely, and we see this again and again in these processes, that we're able to get back on track again. Those three elements, inclusion, deliberation, and power, they really work together very well. They weave in and out of each other very well and allow us to really move forward.
Susan Clark, co-author of Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community, Bringing Decision-Making Back Home. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. And people can find us at slowdemocracy.org.
Thank you so much. When we come back, the elections are over, but polarization continues. What will the new term bring? Up next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned.
Shoes. There's a warning sign on the
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. On Friday, President Obama made his first move to address the so-called fiscal cliff, just one of numerous critical issues that the country faces. Given the recent election, with voters essentially maintaining the power structure and the continued polarization in government, what should we expect from this next term? Mark Peterson joins us. He is a professor of public policy, political science, and law at UCLA. He is the author of books including Legislating Together, The White House and Capitol Hill from Eisenhower to Reagan. Sean Theriault also joins us. He is professor of government at University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution, and Party Polarization in Congress. Matthew Dickinson is with us. He is professor of political science and department chair at Middlebury College. He is the author of Bitter Harvest, FDR, Presidential Power, and the Growth of the Presidential Branch. He's also co-author of The Guardian of the Presidency, The Legacy of Richard E. Neustadt. Mark Peterson, we should start with you. You've written about how the presidency-centered view, people focusing on the presidency that gets reinforced through the media, limits our understanding of how politics and policymaking occurs. You've called it a tandem institutions process really instead. How does this tandem institutions view help us understand what's occurring now in our political process?
I think it's very important for people to have this firm understanding. One of the problems with the campaign process is it reinforces the notion that the president is all-powerful within the system, if you will, and any failings is a failing on the part of the individual incumbent to be able to competently move issues forward. When you have Governor Romney saying, for instance, on day one, I'm going to repeal Obamacare, it's obviously a symbolic statement, but it communicates to people that he could actually have done that, which, of course, he can't. Once you get into office, you appreciate this even more. In this tandem institutions arrangement, we have a system of significant checks and balances that, in combination with the individual House of Representatives and the individual U.S. Senate, both of which have equal power in the system, then engaging with the president, that always sets up a requirement that there be a reasonable level of agreement developed across the institutions. That is made all the more difficult in our contemporary political environment because of the partisan polarization that has occurred. The parties have really separated from one another. The Democrats have moved left through the years. The Republicans have moved even further to the right through the years. And we've really lost much middle ground. And then institutionally in the Senate, I often joke that if you have only 10 seconds to say what's most important about the American political system, it's the United States Senate. And that's because with the filibuster having become a routine instrument of opposition by the minority party, it means that anything of consequence, even the various pieces of anything of consequence, require 60 votes in the Senate, which is a very, very tall order, given the nature of the issues involved, the deep ideological divisions, and the diversity of the country.
You just set up the entire discussion with that. I think we should start first with the changes in the polarization, which is Sean Theriault's work. Sean, can you talk to us about how politics have changed in terms of this polarization? You've looked at it from as far back as the Civil War.
Right. The book that I published a few years ago had it going all the way up until Barack Obama was elected president, looking at data. And what we see there is of course, exactly what he said earlier about the Democrats moving to the left and the Republicans moving to the right. But even since then, the polarization has grown much, much more as a consequence of the Tea Party. It's not only the Tea Party, but it's the fact that a lot of those Tea Party Republicans who were elected in 2010 were replacing moderate Democrats. And so as a consequence of those blue dogs losing to Tea Party folks, the Democratic Party has now even swung more to the left, and the Republicans, with the presence of the Tea Party folks, have swung even more to the right.
What do we attribute this to? Why has it become so polarized?
The parties in Congress now act much more as teams than they used to before. We could imagine that the Democrats and Republicans could get together on some public policy issues, and there would be a significant crossover by a subset of one of the parties joining the other folks to enact real solutions to real problems. What we see now is if minority party members even think of crossing the party line, to vote with the majority party to enact some type of policy change. They're merely giving the majority party more ammunition to use against them in the next election. And so the leaders of both parties are trying very hard to keep all of their members in complete opposition to whatever the majority party wants to propose. And when you have these institutions with different majorities, you can appreciate the problems that there is in passing legislation. Republicans in the House have a set idea of how we should create more jobs in the United States, and they pass bill after bill after bill. I mean, John Boehner will tell you that they passed 30 job bills in the last Congress. But, of course, none of those are taken up in the Senate because Harry Reid and the Democrats can't give the Republicans an issue that they can use against them in the next election. And the same is true with the Democrats in the Senate. They will pass bills that will never see the light of day in the House.
This is Mark. If I could add to that, stated very nicely by Sean, when you've got parties like this in this divided ideological situation, it's really emphasizing the fact that the only thing that matters is which party wins the majority. And so anything that could be done in a way that would disadvantage one party over the other going into the next election becomes untenable. Now, how did all that happen? There were significant historical changes underway that led to this kind of this movement of conservatives into the Republican ranks only and the movement of liberals into the Democratic ranks only. One is we used to have a whole series, several decades, in which Democrats from the South were able to win election as Democrats. In fact, only Democrats could win in the South, but they were conservatives. And so they often had alignments with Republicans on particularly economic issues, on taxes and spending, that meant that there was a conservative coalition that was bipartisan, was Democrats and Republicans, more Republicans than Democrats. And at the same time, you had Republicans who were more moderate and very strong on things like the environment and on some urban issues, who were able to get elected in some of the major urban districts, particularly in the Northeast, going back to some historical roots for the Republican Party. The Southern Democrats got replaced by real conservatives in the Republican Party. The Northern moderate liberal Republicans got replaced by real Democrats, real liberals and real Democrats. And the result is that there's really nobody left who's kind of walking between the two sides. And we now see that gravitating down into the electorate, where you have an electorate that is sorted out more completely towards, for those who have partisan attachments to either party, you know, consider an issue like the environment. The environment used to be one in which there were very strong, powerful leaders in Republican ranks on environmental issues. The Environmental Protection Agency was established by a Republican president, Richard Nixon, and today the parties are completely divided on environmental issues, on whether there ought to be full-bore coal mining and development of fossil fuels on the energy front, whether or not global climate change is a hoax or really embedded in science. This is a completely transformed world because of how the underlying dynamics of the election process is producing who gets into the House in particular and who gets into the Senate for each party.
How much of that do you think is the growing power of particular lobbies, like the fossil fuel industry, for example, in terms of the environment?
This is Matt Dickinson, and I just wanted to amplify a couple of points that Sean and Mark made. One of the ramifications underappreciated with the purification of both parties and their increasing tendency to act like teams, and this is a point Sean's work has shown, the party label now is increasingly important as an electoral force in and of itself. In other words, both parties now have a brand name. That means much more than it used to when you had conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. It used to be we would dismiss the party labels as Tweedledee and Tweedledum. That's no longer the case. And so it matters much more if your party is viewed as winning on an issue than it used to be. A couple of other points that Mark's touched on that are worth amplifying. Residential patterns. There is some evidence that people are moving. Americans are increasingly mobile, and they tend to resettle in areas that are more congenial to them, not necessarily choosing a neighborhood on the basis of partisanship, but on other factors that impact partisanship. So we basically have more partisan residential choices. And a third development has been financial aid. The whole system of financing campaigns, efforts to wipe out the impact of large donors, has opened up a whole new field for small donors. But contrary to what many in the media think, the small donors aren't Joe and Jane Sixpack who are just throwing out their milk money. they're actually the most partisan people. The small donors are the most extreme party members in each, the Republican and the Democratic Party, and their money gravitates towards the most extreme candidates. So if you look at, for instance, in the House, Michelle Bachmann, one of the most conservative members of the House, has been a tremendous fundraiser. And the reason, of course, is because her ideology attracts the notice of these small donors. So our effort to shift the locus of fundraising has inadvertently also contributed to the polarization of political discourse.
Some of the work that I'm doing currently is looking not only at party polarization, but also what I call partisan warriors. These are members in Congress who want to win at all costs. And of course, there are both Democrats and Republicans who typify that characteristic. But what we find is that when you enter the legislative chamber, a place where we think that compromise should happen and solutions are enacted, not with that as your motive, but rather as your motive, trying to find that one issue in which you can defeat your opposition in the next election. And I think that we've always had conservative members and liberal members of the House and the Senate. But what we're finding more and more is that there are many more partisan warriors who are really holding the entire legislative process as hostage in their quest for majority party status.
This is Mark Peterson again. Let me add now what the ramifications of all that are for actual policymaking and what people in the world experience, what the citizens experience when Congress does act. Take healthcare reform, which is one of the areas that I pursue with some vigor. The Affordable Care Act is assembled by the Democrats and the Obama administration, enacted in 2010. On the health insurance side, which is one major part of the act, has as its component parts major things that were developed by Republicans. The mandate originally came out of the Conservative Heritage Foundation and the Senate Republican plan in the early 1990s. The insurance exchanges came from the first Bush administration, and also, of course, Governor Romney's work with the Democratic legislature in Massachusetts. The subsidies for people to buy insurance in an insurance exchange came from Republican plans. The reliance on private insurance alone without any public plan or other kind of public option came out of Republican plans. If that had all happened in the 1970s, say, then there would have been a basis of saying, okay, President Obama, you've acquired some of our ideas. You've added too much of your democratic regulatory notions to them, but at least we're on a common ground and we can have a conversation. Today, in this polarized environment, what had been Republican ideas, which didn't make liberals in the Democratic Party terribly happy, served absolutely no utility in drawing Republicans into the conversation, because once they became President Obama's and the Democrats' ideas, they became a nuclear, and it was impossible for any member on a Republican side to actually have a serious conversation. In fact, people who've interviewed some of the congressional staff during that period have reported back, the staff members would say, our bosses basically said, we can't talk. They're just not going to be able to survive within their own caucus if it looks like we're making overtures to the other side.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the policymaking process and the policies that could come in light of the structure and polarization in government now. It seems to me that the polarization really began during the Newt Gingrich era, and then with President Clinton, who did co-opt some of their ideas, or I shouldn't say co-opt, included some of the Republican ideas, and then was really lambasted. I wonder then what the impetus was. Was it the leadership of people like Gingrich? Was it the birth of Fox News a little bit? How much of it is the influence of particular kinds of powerful lobby groups? Mark Peterson, why don't we start with you? If you could take that apart a little, then we'll pass it around to the others.
Okay, let me try to be brief on this. It was not just Newt Gingrich as speaker. Newt Gingrich had worked very smartly and astutely to mobilize Republicans on the conservative side to run for the state legislature and ultimately to be powerful candidates running for Congress. In 1994, that all came together, and they had a wave of Republicans come into the House and the Senate, have majorities for the first time in 40 years, and they had an agenda to run on, and they had a common ground to run on, and it was very similar in some ways to what we saw after the 2010 elections that brought Republicans back to the House majority this time. The one thing that is encouraging about all that, and this is a scenario that might happen, we just don't know, is recall that there was the big fight between President Bill Clinton and Speaker Gingrich and the Republicans, and we had a shutdown of government, and we had animosities at levels that we had not seen for quite some time. And then President Clinton won re-election. The Republicans retained their majorities in Congress, and somehow we got things like the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 that made fundamental changes to Medicare that, along with other acts, put the country on the road to a surplus rather than a deficit, and that act was passed with very large bipartisan majorities. So the question is, having gone through the current election, having gone through the re-election of President Obama, and having the Republicans hold on to the House, even though they lost narrowly the popular vote for the House, with the Democrats now making some gains in the Senate, and with the so-called fiscal cliff coming up, have we created a scenario now where people are going to have to behave differently, and we get a replay of what happened after the 1996 election?
Matthew Dickinson.
I want to pick up one of the themes that's come up here, the origins of polarization, and again, echo comments made by Sean and Mark. There was a very influential political scientist named James Q. Wilson who wrote a book about really amateur politicians becoming a force in American politics, and he traces that back to the early 1960s, and partly it's driven by the changing nature of the issue pool that our government confronts. When we move from purely materialistic interests, the distribution of tax money and so on, and started moving into other areas, civil rights, the environment, so-called values, partisans began to line up on the basis of non-material issues. And the difference among these types of individuals is they're purists. They believe that they're doing God's work or the secular humanities work, depending on which side they're on. And they're not, you don't compromise on those things the way you can compromise on, for instance, allocating tax cuts or cutting a deal on the size of the budget. Now, to compromise on positions of principle is to sell out something that's more important. And we see elements of this on both sides of the party, right? Whether we're talking about environmentalists and global climate change or gun control, it runs deeper than simply differences over how much people should get. It's over what government should be doing. And that has become, unfortunately, that difference of principle has been lined up with party brand names. And so winning the partisan battle is all that much more important to these partisans on both sides. The second point I would bring up is that you alluded to is this is now spilled over into the internet and to the media coverage, so that now rather than people listening to a sort of a bland national Uncle Walter Cronkite, for instance, who you know may be skewed moderately left or right, we instead can pick and choose among our own news source, our own version of reality, if you will, and that reality is often skewed to create an echo chamber effect, so that we're basically preaching from the same hymnal whenever we hear the news. It's an echo chamber which reinforces our own views. And taken to an extreme, if any of your readers or your listeners are on Twitter, the Tweeterverse.
I like Twitter.
It's the most partisan of all. People cannot talk civilly to one another. And so that's, an example of where technology has picked up on larger demographical trends and accentuated them.
Sean Theriault.
Right. The one thing that I would add to Matthew's really thoughtful comments is that 1980, and when Ronald Reagan was elected, that presented a new era of American politics in which both chambers were going to be seriously contested every single election. In 1980, the Republicans take over the Senate, and then 14 years later, with Newt Gingrich, the Republicans take back the House. And then ever since then, every single election day, we wake up and we're not sure which party is going to control the House or the Senate. Which means that both of those parties, when they're meeting in Congress and when they're trying to figure out solutions to problems, there is always in the back of their mind and more and more frequently in the front of their mind how it is that they can gain electoral advantage over the other party. Back in the 1960s and 70s, I think almost everyone in Washington recognized that in the next election, the Democrats would once again be a majority in the House and they'd be a majority in the Senate. And so they focused all of their energies on gaining the White House. And it meant that the Republicans inside Congress were more than willing to work with Democrats because that was the only way that they were going to have some kind of influence in the policy that would ultimately be enacted. But once Republicans thought that they had a chance, then it meant that bipartisan cooperation had to be sacrificed on the altar of electoral politics.
And there's one issue, this is Mark again, that you've raised a couple times now that we haven't addressed, and that's the role of lobbying and the money that goes into the system. And I just wanted to say a couple things about that. One is, I don't think it's the case that money per se, quote-unquote, buys votes in Congress. There's no amount of money from the mining industry that would have gotten Barney Frank to vote for mining coal. There's no amount of money from George Soros that would have gotten Tom DeLay to have a different view about environmental issues. But what has happened is, just as the parties have become polarized in Congress and the House and Senate, just as the electorate has sorted out a bit more in terms of ideology overlaying on party identification, the interest group system has also developed more of a polarization. And so there are a set of interests that work continuously and directly with Republicans in government and in Congress, and they tend to be the corporate interests, they tend to be the fossil fuel industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and so on, and they are reliable partners, just as now there are reliable partners for the Democrats that come out of the environmental movement, the consumer movement, the women's movement, in what that partisan alignment of the interest groups did not used to be so strong. In fact, in political science, long ago, E.E. Schatzmeier claimed that you could have either a weak interest group system and a strong party system, or a strong interest group system and a weak party system. And I think, and I wrote about this years ago with Jack Walker, I think that's just wrong, that we've actually seen the reinforcement of both simultaneously, and it accentuates the partisan ideological divisions.
There's one other thing that you had brought up, Mark, and that is that the Senate is very strong because of the filibuster rule. And now, as we're going back into an upcoming session, it's something that is being discussed in terms of trying to get some of these policies off the table that have been sitting there for a long time, and all the judicial nominees. Then we saw what happened with Elizabeth Warren. Matt, you defend the filibuster.
I defend it in the sense that it is often viewed purely as an unadulterated evil that is preventing the majority from exercising its will. But in part, your view towards the filibuster is predicated on your view towards the role of the minority in the Senate and how much procedural protection should there be for minority rights. And political scientists disagree on this. Very prominent political scientists fall down on both sides of the debate here. And my only argument is, if you view the Senate is a deliberative body, and that deliberation means the minority must have a voice, or whether you think it should be more like the House, in which currently, if you are in the minority, you have no voice whatsoever, that may condition your support of filibuster reform. Now, advocates of filibuster reform say, we don't want to eliminate the minority, but we want to make it much more difficult for a committed minority to block any action at all. What we want to do is encourage deliberation, not foreclose it. The problem right now with the filibuster rule is it doesn't encourage debate so much as it ends it. Any time a controversial issue comes up, the Senate moves immediately for a cloture vote. And if they can't get that, then that's it. That's the end of it. And if they do get it, that's also the end of it. But there's not real debate. Most of the debate is taking place on not on the policy itself, but on whether that policy can be debated. The second thing I would point out is not just the filibuster that's holding up a lot of these judicial nominations. And you're quite right. I mean, it's not just judicial nominations. It's executive appointments in general. The delay in filling in your team has just lengthened by weeks, if not months, for incoming administrations. But there's also legislative holds, unofficial agreements, under-publicized agreements in which individual members basically inform the leadership that unless something is tabled for the moment, they're going to take the next step and threaten the filibuster. So I think there's a role for the minority to continue, but it should be a role that encourages minority input into deliberation. It shouldn't be a role that stymies all deliberation entirely.
This is Mark. A very nicely stated summary of where we are with the filibuster by Matt. The one thing I would add that I think feeds the negative perceptions of the filibuster is the fact that, given the way the Senate is constituted, you have two senators from every state. And that means that the filibustering minority may be not only a party minority in the Senate, but really a very, very representing a very, very small minority of the American population. And so it concerns people that not only do you have this potential for obstruction and not having full deliberation, but that that obstruction can come from really a pretty small part of the American electorate. And that just complicates how we think about that role of protecting the capacity for the minority to have a voice in the system.
Sean Theriault?
The only thing that I would add to this really thoughtful conversation is that the idea of the filibuster, the way that the filibuster works today, has undergone a radical transformation. Most Americans learn of the filibuster, of course, through Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And, of course, the picture we have of that filibuster was Mr. Smith on the floor for hours and hours and hours and sweating and tired and exhausted. And so the person conducting the filibuster was the one that bore all the costs of having the filibuster. But what we've seen more recently is that the people trying to break the filibuster are the ones that are having to invest all the time and energy, and the people who are threatening the filibuster can merely get off by just saying that they want to filibuster it, and that forces the majority in the Senate frequently to bear all the costs of trying to invoke cloture.
Just another quick reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Professors Mark Peterson, Sean Theriault, and Matt Dickinson about how the current structure and state of affairs is shaping the next set of policies. We have coming up a whole series of important issues. Let's talk for a bit about how this might go. We know that the presidents have also increasingly used methods such as executive orders. We also have a bully pulpit that has been used from time to time to try to push issues down the pike. How do we see this upcoming session in terms of all of the very important issues that are facing America? Mark Peterson, I think you started to talk about how we might see it look more like Clinton's second term. What do you think?
I think it's quite possible, and it may be facilitated a little bit by the fact that the metaphor of the fiscal cliff is actually not quite accurate. There's a kind of drop-dead date in the sense that the failure to come to another compromise will lead to the triggering of these cuts in various programs, cuts in defense, and also the just as scheduled, the disappearance of the Bush tax cuts. But in fact, there could be a period of weeks or months afterwards in which there could still be the generation of a compromise, and then there can be a lot of retrospective action on taxes and even on filling in some of the spending cuts. So there's more latitude to act, although it does create a kind of action-forcing environment, one of which that people on both sides are not happy about some of those elements. So that's possible. The other thing that's happened is that, as happened in 1994, many of the people who came into Congress on the Republican side in 2010 from the Tea Party movement with this passion for changing the direction of American government, from their point of view, saving the country from the government in some ways, they've had a two-year education in just what it means to try to move things through the legislative process. They've had a two-year education in the complexities of representing a very large and diverse country. And for some of them, that's going to probably mean a little more understanding of the need for compromise, not on their principles, but a compromise on the kinds of key issues of how you handle the budget, how you handle taxation, and so on. It may be that they're more fervent and more pure than the group that came in with Gingrich in the 94, created the speakership for Gingrich in the 94 election. But my guess is that you get a pretty strong education, and they've also seen the position that their leader, John Boehner, has been put in by not being able to rely on his caucus when it comes to making some of these major compromises.
Matthew Dickinson.
You mentioned the use of the bully pulpit, and I'm reminded of George Bush's pronouncement after he won re-election and actually increased the size of his coalition, which is not what happened with Obama just this past week, and proclaiming that he had earned political capital and he was going to spend it. And he then went out on a barnstorming tour designed to pressure wavering Democrats whose voting coalition seemed weak, more likely to support Republicans. And he basically tried to use the bully pulpit as leverage to get these people to sign on to Social Security reform. It went nowhere. And that's consistent generally with what we find in our studies of presidents' ability to move public opinion by taking to the airwaves. It's just not as powerful as you might think We have all these visions of looking at Franklin Roosevelt going on radio, but the reality is he rarely did that, and did so on issues in which there was broad popular support. It's just a myth to think, particularly with the fragmented national media outlets that we have today, there's simply not an audience for the size that there used to be for presidential pronouncements. And the other actors have their own access to these media outlets and their own versions of the bully pulpit. So the use of the bully pulpit in and of itself is not going to help Barack Obama achieve a lot of his objectives for all the reasons we pointed out. Members of Congress are responding to their own audience, and there is some overlap with the president's, but they're by no means the same.
And what about the executive order use? Will that be effective?
Well, in the potential for it in certain areas, depending on the issue, to be effective is there. And we've seen President Obama make use of executive orders in the first term. But there are limits. Technically speaking, you cannot use an executive order, for instance, to do something that involves spending money if the money hasn't been appropriated already. Anything that's done in an executive order can be undone by executive order by the next administration. We saw a flurry of executive orders issued by George Bush going out, being rescinded through his own executive orders by Barack Obama coming in. And also you face, you know, the prospect that the executive order itself involves implementation. You can order an agency to do something. You can order the military to do something. But if the individuals who are receiving that order aren't necessarily keen on implementing, they have ways of working with Congress to delay implementation. So, yes, there is room for unilateral action, so-called unilateral action through administrative orders, through executive orders. But I think the chance for whole-scale policy change is probably less than you might think.
Sean Theriault.
The only thing that I would add is the executive order action is also not the way the Constitution intended our government to work. The legislative branch was in charge of creating laws, and it was the executive branch that was supposed to execute those laws. And the danger is that by allowing presidents all of this extra power through executive order, is that it in essence gives Congress an excuse not to act. And I think that's dangerous. That's a dangerous precedent. And both parties and both institutions are to blame. I mean, certainly George Bush used a lot of executive orders, as does Barack Obama. And the Democrats allowed George Bush to do it, and the Republicans are allowing Barack Obama to do it. And I just think that that's a really dangerous precedent.
It just struck me. I remembered a biography I had read on Phil Burton and one little vignette about how he used to go into other congressmen's districts and negotiate with the interests that were there in order to pass his legislation. Do we ever see anything like that occurring anymore?
Mark actually raised an interesting point, which might touch on this issue. Healthcare, we forget that in addition to the constraints imposed on presidents by operating in a system of shared powers at the national level, we also have a federalist system, and a lot of the healthcare policy, the degree, and Mark can probably speak to this, the degree to which is implemented depends on the cooperation of state governments, right? The setting up of these insurance exchanges, the degree to which and the size of the Medicaid waivers you get. So that's an additional constraint. A lot of the battle over healthcare implementation is going to take place not in the national government, but at state governments. And it's not clear to me to what degree that partisans in both sides are sort of negotiating with state and local officials on this. I don't know, Mark, if you want to speak to that.
Yes, thanks, Matt. There's a great deal of negotiation going on, and particularly among in those states that have Republican governors and legislatures. There have been a number of gubernatorial administrations that have very quietly been in conversation with the Department of Health and Human Services. It has to be quiet, because if it were more than that, it would create a backlash among the more conservative elements of the governor's party. But one of the great ironies is that, of course, under the Affordable Care Act, the insurance exchanges can either be set up by the states or by a regional coalition of states, or if they choose not to act, then the federal government steps in. And where we've had the most ideological response from Republican governors and legislatures who say adamantly that they're not going to play any role in setting these exchanges up, such as Governor Scott in Florida, again, reaffirmed today. The irony is that the federal government will be setting up those exchanges, and you'll actually have a greater federal presence in those states. And so the ideological divide and the effects of polarization are streaming down into the ranks of federalism as well, and making it more difficult to for these kinds of things to play out in the more quiet negotiations that have gone on in the past.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to end. Let me thank the three of you. Mark Peterson, professor of public policy, political science, and law at UCLA. He's the author of Legislating Together, The White House and Capitol Hill from Eisenhower to Reagan, co-editor of Institutions of American Democracy, the Executive Branch, and contributor to Institutions of American Democracy, A Republic Divided. Matthew Dickinson is professor of political science and the department chair at Middlebury College. He's the author of Bitter Harvest, FDR, Presidential Power, and the Growth of the Presidential Branch, co-editor of The Guardian of the Presidency, The Legacy of Richard Neustadt, and editor of the blog Presidential Power, a nonpartisan analysis of presidential politics. And Sean Theriault is professor of government at the University of Texas in Austin. He's the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution, and Party Polarization in Congress. Thank you, gentlemen, so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and assistant producers Amanda Vigil and Kenneth Jackson. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at armudian. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.
Alone in a cold, cruel